My name is Tyler Fornes, and I am one of the co-hosts of the Good, the Bad, and the Hungy AEW podcast here on the Voice of Wrestling Podcasting Network. We take a broad scope approach to the world of All Elite Wrestling and the entire universe of Tony Khan. We talk about the big matches, the big stars, the promos, the storylines, and we also look at it from a big picture perspective. How are things going to change over the course of the next 10 years with AEW still in the picture? How are companies like WWE going to adapt and adjust to AEW? Are they going to be a similar way like they did with WCW in the late 1990s? Will there be a counterpunch? We talk about all of that and more on The Good, The Bad, and The Hungy every week on the Voices of Wrestling Network.
Wrestling Omakase is back, baby. The weekly podcast that takes you across all the top promotions on the entire Japanese wrestling scene. From New Japan to Stardom, NOAH, DDT, All Japan, Marie Gold, Dragon Gate, Tokyo Joshi, Sendai Girls, and a whole lot more. I'm John Carroll, a fan of Japanese wrestling for over 20 years, and every week I'm joined by a rotating cast of guest co-hosts as we break down all the top promotions in Japan, men's and women's. Check out Wrestling Omakase right here on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network today.
This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
To the highway, in a brand new day. Gotta let it go. So far, rain is a car. Fast to freedom. Down. Stars tonight.
Welcome back to Open the Voice Gate for July 29th, 2025. We are members of the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. You can find Open the Voice Gate on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network feed or on our own dedicated Open the Voice Gate feed. Wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us on social media at Open Voice Gate. If you'd like to donate to the show, click the link in the show notes. It'll take you to our redcircle.com landing site. You click the red box that says sponsor this podcast and you accept a one-time or reoccurring donation. No obligation whatsoever, but we would like to thank our previous donors. I'm one of your hosts. It's your old pal, Mike Spears, being joined alongside, as always, your other co-host, Case Lowe. And Case, I'm just going to hand the ball to you because I know you've been busy today. How are you, buddy?
Very tired, Mike Spears, but that's okay. I'm very happy to be here. Very appreciative of the response for the most recent Those Days episode, which if you missed it, you did indeed miss a Those Days episode. We are nearing the end of 1994. We covered August and September of 94 in this most recent episode, which includes how a Jushin Thunder Liger broken leg drastically altered the course of Michinoku Pro that year. I am also tired, as Mike and I were talking about before we started recording, because I once again had a sit-down interview recorded with Tony Khan of AEW fame, obviously, earlier today. So this is not a replay. This is not an old audio file being uploaded. I have a new conversation with Tony, our third one in the last year, that will be live as of Wednesday, July 30th at 9 a.m. Central. So if this gets uploaded overnight, look for it then. If it is past that time when you are listening to this, it will be on the same YouTube channel that all of my previous conversations with Tony Khan have been on. There is some exciting news in that interview. If you're an AEW fan in the Chicagoland area, a show coming to that market that I think will have a lot of people excited. And then in this one, there's a lot of Tony wrestling fan stuff. You know, Tony talking about tape trading. He gave me a very detailed answer on what his most cherished tape trading possession is, which I greatly appreciated. We talked about what the best hour of episodic wrestling TV of all time is, non-AEW shows included. And, you know, like always, he's just a very charming, very personable guy. And I thought we had another great conversation. So while this maybe won't draw the ire of Conan or Jim Cornette, or maybe it will, like our most recent conversation did, then still certainly it's one going out of your way to listen to or watch on YouTube and then leave a nice comment, because it makes me look good at my shoot job.
I mean, like, how does the station feel about that? Like, somehow, like, they have a hidden ace up their sleeve, and this is one of the emerging pro wrestling interviewers on record. Like,
you know,
like,
funny,
how does management handle this?
Well, management likes it, because I have a great rapport with my boss, where I go, hey, I think I'm gonna do this, and he goes, knock yourself out. But it's fun. We were talking about this on the air a few days ago, where, for instance, Lollapalooza is this week in Chicago, and I'm trying to round up all of these artist interviews, and the bands that I go out and hunt interviews for, I'm not banging down Sabrina Carpenter's door, at least in this case, you know, God willing, one day. But it's not like I'm trying to interview the most famous bands in the world. I really want all of these poor, grimy punk bands to like and enjoy doing interviews with me. And there's a few at Lolla this year. There's a band called Tsunami who's playing Lolla this year, and I've got an interview with them. And all I can think is, like, God, I hope that guy likes me. I know he plays in a punk band that when they're in Chicago, they play to maybe 600 people, but it would mean the world to me if this guy thought I was cool. Meanwhile, I have literal billionaire, top of the industry, Tony Khan, who's like, hey, can I come by and do another interview? And it will never sink in where my priorities are, where I'm like, I really hope this poor punk band likes me, but sure, Tony, you can stop on by. But no, it's become a great thing. I think, given one of the announcements in the upcoming interview, I think Tony and I will probably have one more sit down later this year. We're going to give it some time. We're going to let some TV unfold. And then I think Tony will be back in the studio for one more sit down in 2025. At least that's the goal. And if I have my way, AEW and I have been discussing something potentially very cool with Tony Khan. It's just a matter of getting all the right people in line for what I want to do, which I think if it ever happened would be incredibly enjoyable. But I greatly appreciate Tony's time. I greatly appreciate his openness and his honesty. And it's another fun conversation. This one, again, very much a conversation with Tony, the wrestling fan, and not always AEW founder Tony Khan. So a very fun one. Again, 9 a.m. on July 30th. That'll be up.
Yeah, I can't wait. I wonder what Tony's takes are on Jeff Lynch's infamous PDFs. I imagine he has some views on various traders and stuff
it's,
like that.
It's amazing his recall of, I don't want to blow his high spot, but tape trading came up early in the interview. I wanted to ask Tony this last time, and I didn't get a chance to because we had so much to talk about. But I ask him, I go, you know, what's the tape that you remember not being able to get to the mailbox quick enough for? Because I referenced a point in time where the PWG DVDs were the most valuable thing in my life. And it was the serotonin hit of watching the YouTube preview, which even that's like such a thing of the past now. And Mike, you remember this.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
PWG would drop a DVD trailer on a Monday night. They would do it in the middle of Raw, and it would just immediately cease conversation about what was happening on Raw, and for the rest of the night it would become what was happening in the PWG preview, and then you would have to wait another few weeks and then you get the DVD in the mail. And I made the reference to him. I go, I remember specifically the PWG show with the Bucks versus AR Fox and Samurai Del Sol. Also had a 1 hour Iron Man match between Sami Callihan and Adam Cole that I don't think has aged as well as it did, as much as I liked it in 2013. But I remember the feeling physically of not being able to get to the mailbox fast enough to get that DVD, to get it inside, to put it in the DVD player, and then to watch the show. And Tony, I love him because I ask him this question and he goes, well, I have a VHS answer and I have a DVD answer. And I go, of course you do. And so
I respect that so much. You have no idea.
Yes. And so his VHS answer is incredibly interesting. Really. It wasn't what I was expecting him to say. And then his DVD answer is one that if you If you like this podcast, it's not anything Drangate related, but if you like this podcast, you'll very much respect the answer that he gave for the DVD. And then, you know, we talked about Mark Briscoe and we talked about the idea of AEW building their own building for wrestling, sort of inspired by Arena Mexico. And I thought his answers were interesting there. And then we closed out with a world-class and Mid-South conversation and what good wrestling TV looks like. So again, very, very enjoyable.
Yeah, I can't wait to get that. But Case, Dragon Gate is now back on the network after their... It seems to be like, with everything kind of changing with the schedule over the last few years, we actually had kind of an old standby, a kind of longer break away from TV like we are used to see in 2014 and around that era. But we came, but the promotion came back on the network over the last week. We'll be talking about Buyiden as well as the monthly jaunt to Kobe Sambo Hall and how all of that is kind of playing into this Dangerous Gate card coming up in August that very quickly we knew at the final moments of Kobe World, the direction we were going with Shun Skywalker versus Madoka Kakuta. And we have that essentially play out for us, like the aftermath of the Kobe World show close angle with this Royal Sambo main event that we had in Kobe Sambo Hall on Saturday. A Royal Sambo that was just Z-Bratz and Shun Skywalker and Himari, ending with Shun Skywalker eliminating both himself and Madoka Kakuta with a blaster onto the apron to end that. And we are already like full force going towards Dangerous Gate. What was your takeaway of this use of Royal Sambo? Because I thought that this was actually like not necessarily expected, but I felt like that this was like a real remarkable kind of use of the match to play out the storyline.
I have 2 points on this. My first point is, doesn't it feel like World was 6 years ago?
3 months ago.
Like, yeah. What the fuck? And it's been 2 weeks. And I don't know if it's just my life or if it's the way that we consume gobs and gobs of media now. World was 2.5 weeks ago. It could not have felt longer ago.
Yeah, I mean, I think that like we had like this scenario at least. For me personally, like after World, I went away for a couple days and then I came back and I was already focused on moving to a new house. So it just kind of, I had so much stuff going on that kind of put it that way. But also when like you look at like what's going on with the rest of the wrestling world right now, and it's like, oh, we are now addressing Kobe World. Geez, that feels like that happened back in May.
Absolutely insane. So yes, in terms of the Royal Sambo main event, you know, I balked at the idea of it on paper because they've been doing these Sambos now since, 2021, I think?
It started coming back with Ultimo, but not necessarily in this building.
No, so, but the permanent battle
Royal Sambo fixture, thing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, let me look at Stalker's cage match real quick because he, you know. Yeah,
that is the way to figure that out.
Yeah, I mean, you got to remember, right. You know, this goes back to the Stalker Ichikawa win streak, which... Even on cage match, I got to scroll back quite a ways to find because he's wrestling pretty regularly through 2022. Yeah, I mean they have been doing these since the beginning of 2022 or maybe the end of 2021 because it looks like SB Kento might have won the first Royal Sambo in Kobe. So that's how far we're going back there. SB Kento, Genki Horiguchi, Konamami Ichikawa, Prom Dragon, Punch Tamanaga, Sachi Hoka Boy, Super Shisa, Strong Machine J, Susumu, UT, and Yosuke. I believe that's the first one that there was. So that's how far back we're going here. But I balked at the idea initially because I vastly prefer this structure of match as undercard fodder, a chance for the young guys and the Genki Horiguchi types to get in the ring and do something. I guess I would rather this match in general be meaningless rather than have high stakes attached to it. So I wasn't looking forward to watching this show, and I think a lot of that was based on just what this main event was. And then they went out there, and not only do I like the overall story that they told, I thought the individual performances of Shun and Kakuta, who are the guys that matter most, and Himare in particular, were really, really strong. And I really liked what I saw. So I have to hand it to him. This is something I was not originally invested in, but I really got there by the end of this match.
And just kind of the way that they set it up. And so you had a match that essentially had nine people in it. And instead of doing kind of the old style of the Royal Sambo, like you immediately had kind of like a handicap match, for lack of better terms, happening in the early going with it. You have Himare near immediately eliminating Yoshiki Kato with Momo Latch, and then that bringing out Kaien Ishin and then Minoli, and then lo and behold, right after that, you had a huge beatdown on Himare. Then Shun Skywalker and Kakuta are the last two entrants. Shun Skywalker sprints to the ring and immediately eliminates Kai and Jason while Kakuta's kind of sauntering. And you have, like, then you go into the crowd brawl. Ishin misdirection eliminates Minoru. And then after the long crowd brawl, Kakuta takes out Himare. Shun eliminates Ishin. Then you have that final stretch on the apron. And Case, I don't remember a time in history where I've ever written down everything that happens in a Royal Sambo. That's how remarkable of a match I felt like this was, because we see them use this format sometimes where, like, it was like, can you stop the who can stop the Ichikawa? And then going through like Natural Vibes versus Zebrats being a feature with this, but not necessarily as like a way to kind of play out this level of a high of like the top feud happening in the company. And there's a bit of me that goes, ooh, I feel like you have this in Cork and Hall, and this adds a little bit more to like the spectacle of it. And that's kind of where we get, where we're somewhat conditioned to see like these big moments in Dragon Gate. But instead, like, they play it out here in front of a hometown crowd. And I felt like it's easily like the best Royal Sambo match that they've had in years, I feel like.
In quite some time, absolutely, because it did have that juice to it. And so while it's not something that I would want to see them rely on heavily, it is something that when they did decide to put the stakes to the degree that they were, it actually ended up being a refreshing change of pace. And I wasn't sure they were going to get there when the match was initially announced. What was interesting to me is that although we are far from his final form and the evolution that we're seeing, we have lived multiple lives, it feels like, since Shun Skywalker has been a babyface. I mean, you know, the turn happened in January of 2022, but even months before then, really going back to October, November of 2021, there was dissension and masquerade and us getting the feeling that he was going to go heel. And just through international expansion and changes in the roster, you know, Shun Skywalker became undeniably sort of the 1B to this company's Yamato 1A during that time, all as a heel. And while I never doubted the idea that he'd be able to turn back and would once again be a great babyface wrestler, it was almost, comforting is the word that I want to use, it was almost comforting to see Shun working from underneath, taking the brunt of Kakuta's offense, and slowly morphing back into a babyface role that has been obviously so absent from his approach for so many years now.
Yeah, and I think it's kind of remarkable, at least on this show, Shun was not on Buyeden, but on this show, even in the open, at least the hometown fans are along for the ride for Shun now turning face. Like, the most Shun towels I feel like I've seen in one of these openings. And I like the way that, at least right now, if you go to the Gayora website, they're still listed as members of Zebrats, but Shun and Himare are wearing like their Rey de Parejas team outfits right now. So it's that level of difference. Whereas Zebrats, I think we're starting to see either people are still having like the black and yellow of it. So we're really still in kind of in the thick of it. And actually, like, the kind of like a thing for me is like this match feels like it's happening a little bit out of sequence, and maybe that's why it kind of took me aback a little bit, Case, because this felt like a match that you would have in the lead up as like the go home to the big show or before the next big angle, right? And instead we're having it in Sambo Hall in front of what was a particularly light looking crowd, I felt like, on Sunday.
It was also expressed to me by somebody there that it was a particularly light looking crowd in the building.
Yeah. So it was an awesome segment, an awesome match, like a way, like you talked with Tony about favorite 16 minutes of wrestling. This felt like it could be a part of that, but it feels like that would have been a part of that either in Corkin or further down the road for me.
We're in an interesting position where Shun is going to have to move the needle as a babyface champion. And the frustrating part is, and I've maintained this the entire time, I wouldn't have changed a thing about Yamato's title run. I don't think they could have put this company in a better position to succeed. And I'm now at a point, not that one Kobe Sambo Hall show or really even one Corkin show would cause me to make a drastic sweeping generalization, but I am at a odd point where it's like, I don't understand what is going to move the needle, because I think this has been an incredibly well-booked promotion this year. It might be my favorite booked promotion. Now, look, AEW has had higher highs. CMLL especially has had a really nice few months where I thought they had a bit of a dormant spring, but they're white hot right now.
Yeah, and okay, so I'd say, for a point of clarification, because I agree with you, we're talking about best book, not best promotion, because I don't think there's any way you could back up the booking argument with the business to make that claim for Dragon Gate.
And normally I find those two to be directly correlated. It makes sense that the best book promotion is the one that we're enjoying the most, but with Dragon Gate, it's like, man, there's not a lot of holes in this booking this year. I think they've gone through the motion of elevating guys to new levels, but we're not seeing the payoff of any of that. I'm still stunned that they're not doing 1500 in Corkin comfortably every month. Forget what you want to say about the big shows, but it's just something has to happen here. And I thought, again, coming out of World, I was like, man, they nailed that Kakuta angle. There's a very clear dynamic here between Shun and Kakuta, and I think that title match in August could go any way. And your first show after that in your home base of Kobe, and it's, a sparsely attended Lights on Kobe Sambo Hall show. And it's like, well, wait a minute. Like, what? They don't seem to be able to build any momentum at the box office. They seem to have these really good shows in a vacuum, and it doesn't seem to carry over, which is just odd. I don't remember a lot of promotions that are hitting their head on the ceiling the way that Dragon Gate is right now.
Yeah, and I guess that I have like two kind of, I don't know if they're conflicting points, but I think they're kind of two things kind of worth considering. Kobe World was 2 weeks before this Kobe Sambo Hall show. I think that does not explain away a single thing that happened there. I think, though, that can obviously, having the biggest show of the year and then 2 weeks later going back to like your usual small house and basically people maybe deciding like, oh, I spent all that money at Kobe World and they'll be back here next month. That is a line of reasoning that I can entirely buy for the local fans. Like, I think that's worth considering. And secondarily, I wasn't planning on having this kind of discussion with you this week, Case, but I've been having this.
Oh no, are you leaving me?
No, not whatsoever. But it's more of this kind of, I feel like, at least with the way I consume wrestling and the analysis that kind of is generated from that I usually have, I wouldn't say more of a pessimistic kind of mindset. I just kind of am someone that when I look at data, sometimes it just makes me kind of worry about the future, right? Like that's something I do. But over the last few months and really like this year with the booking and how that hasn't really resulted in the business receipts that one would expect when, at least with Dragon Gate booking as well. I mean, you look through the times and the other peaks and the promotion, and and those usually would correlate pretty well. And there's also other considerations like that we have to acknowledge in those peak periods, especially for what Dragon Gate was doing and where the overall pro wrestling landscape was in Japan at those times. Like there's these things can't be considered apart. They are somewhat linked. It could be tenuous, or if you believe in the idea that Dragon Gate, at least at its core, and if you believe that they have a fan base that's all their own and it's not exactly linked to the overall wrestling landscape, that it's their own thing, so it shouldn't be as dependent on that. You can make that argument. But I just look at this business and I look at what has happened with the promotion and how strongly it's booked. And I go back to the last few years case, and I'm wondering if there is like such a hesitancy, or conversely, so many people that have been kind of turned off from the promotion over the last few years, be it departures, be it basically what all has happened over the last decade. And because it does feel like when you look at this and when you have covered a promotion like this, the ways that we do case, sometimes like the answer is kind of tough. And I am kind of at a point where I'm wondering with Dragon Gate sometimes, where is this like a decline that's happening? Like, to be frank, because I think the last 7 years and COVID and all of that have done a number on the wrestling scene, and in particular Dragon Gate. And I don't know. I've had this kind of bouncing around in my head for the last few months. And when a couple of weeks ago for our Kobe World Showcase, when I was kind of fixating on the 5,000 number, that was kind of a little bit of an exercise for me. Like when I'm watching Dragon Gate, think about Dragon Gate, thinking like, okay, if I'm going to feel really super positive about the promotion's future, what is a number I wanted to see at Kobe World? It didn't get hit. So you have that, and you have a number like this. And, you know, the banging sound in your head gets a little bit louder and louder. And I don't know. I feel like I've kind of word vomited for the last few minutes. What do you think about that?
I guess my response to that is, with Japan specifically at this point, I am only comparing Dragon Gate to what the rest of the industry is doing. Sure. That is the thing that intrigues me most, because I think it's an oversimplification to say that, well, over is over and COVID is gone, and there's no reason that the numbers that existed for either any promotion in 2015 can't exist now, or specifically for Dragon Gate, we're looking at numbers 2019 and beyond. I don't think it's that simple. And I always try to remind people, there's a Shun Skywalker versus Yuki Yoshioka Open the Dream Gate match from January 2023 that was contested under a clap crowd, limited capacity setting. In America, we were 2 full years removed from that. And in Japan, we had Dreamgate matches in Korakuen where the crowd wasn't allowed to make noise nearly for 4 straight years. And it is obvious.
Restrictions too, up to 2023 as well. Yes.
So it is obvious that COVID has done tremendous long-term damage to the fan base of Japanese wrestling at large. It's why I continue to harp on now being, you know, a capital S, capital R Stardom respecter, because I find what Stardom has done this year to be fascinating, and it's good for them. You know, I was the first one to shoo away their COVID era success because I found a lot of it to be overhyped and not entirely warranted. And now I'm not sure we're making a big enough deal about some of the houses that Stardom has done this year. In terms of Dragon Gate, I don't know, man. I think this is a much better promotion than All Japan right now. I think this is a much better promotion than Noah right now. And I'm just a little shocked at the tail end of this Yamato run and the earliest of early returns on this Shun Skywalker story are not paying more dividends.
What would you say? Let me just, since we're kind of already off this beaten path, indulge me with this. I'm going to pull up what the number was for Dangerous Gate last year. just because let's talk year on year, and this would be like the first essential, I would say, test of, I would say the first real test of Shun Skywalker, right? All right. Shun, the show last year for Dangerous Gate, this was at Yokohama, which is worth stating. They did not run Oda Ward Sim City Gymnasium last year. It was under, I think it was under renovations, 2138. If, what number are you hoping to see in August for Dangerous Gate with that in mind?
Well, I've got to, hold on, I've got to look at what they did in 2019. That's what I've got to base it off of, because that's the year we have to compare it to, and I don't know what they did that year, and I have Stalker's Wikipedia page up. He did not work Dangerous Gate that year, so give me one more second. I got to figure this out, but that's the number that I want to compare it to. So they did what, 2100 for Dangerous Gate last year in Yokohama?
Yeah, they did 2139 for Dangerous Gate in Yokohama. They did 3394 in 2019 in Dangerous Gate. Benkei retaining against Yamato headlining.
So 3,000 is a massive win. 2,700 is like, all right, but 3,000 is a massive win.
What happens if they show up and they just get 2250?
I think that's the reality we're living in. I see no evidence to support that they won't just do that. You know, I was almost hoping, not because we have a rooting interest in it, but just because I like when people are excited about things. When they announced Shun versus Kakuta so quickly coming out of World, I was like, oh man, maybe they'll clear out a few different sections of seating off of that match alone. And they haven't. They've got sections with limited availability, but you know, you can get a Dangerous Gate ticket online very, very easily at this point. And that was the one that jumped out to me, just because as a pro wrestling fan, and this is, I mean, you know, you and I get, I think, accused of a lot of things, but it's not like we've been banging this drum for 4 years of like, you know what promotion is well booked from top to bottom all the time? Dragon Gate. That really hasn't been our beat up until this Yamato title run. And I'm just very surprised that I think they continue to do artistically all of the right things, or at least almost all of the right things, and we're not seeing the payoff that you would want there.
Yeah, and I guess like it kind of got to a point for me where I'm like wondering, like, okay, at what point does things turn around? Because it just, you're playing like your highest cards like all the time, and it's drawing the exact same. And at least coming out of Kobe Sambo Hall, I don't know what you could do to further build Kakuta and Shun Skywalker in that way. And of course, we have the card for the Corkin Hall show that's coming up on the 5th already. And you're basing the main event, Shun Skywalker and Himari versus Kakuta and Ishin. Worth noting, Ishin in this, after having the miscommunication in Royal Sambo for that. I guess like I'm really looking towards next Tuesday, or yeah, no, that's next Tuesday. I have not lost that calendar.
Why don't we break down the card for that here?
Yeah. So Gate of Adventure, it's Tuesday, 6:30 local time start. That means it's 4:30 in central time zone. The main event again, Shun Mare versus Kakuta and Ishin. Semi-main event, D Courage, Yuki Oshioka, Dragon Dai, and Roy Tanaka versus Minoli and Kai. The special tag match that was teased between Flamita and Luis Monte versus Los Golpadores, Dragon Bane, and Alpha Wolf will be happening on this cork. And Love and Peace, Benkei's not in this one. He's in the match before this, but it's Hyo, Jackie Kamei, Rita, and Mochizuki Jr. versus Paradox, Yamato, Dragon Kid, Susumu, and Doi. Kazuma Kimura's debut match against Benkei. Then you have Natural Vice versus Ultimo, Bandito, and Punch No Tominaga. BB Hulk and Kagatora versus Masaki Mochizuki and Daiki Yanagiuchi open up the August 5th Korkin.
What do you think about this card top to bottom?
I mean, I like it a lot. You have the tag match that you were promising before the... Well, it happened with Dragon Bane before, and I'm glad they're delivering on that. You have a debut, and I think that that's kind of notable, doing it in Korkin, and having Benkei as the opponent, I feel like kind of gives you an idea at least where Kimura might be slotted or like where they kind of view him right now.
It's also an interesting spot for Ben. We don't really see him in that spot.
No,
ever.
It is usually if it's a high grade prospect, it's Yamato or like Mochizuki, someone of that tenure. But if it's someone that's not necessarily that kind of thing, then you might see Don Fuji or Kagetora. But Benkei is rarely a part of these.
Yeah, yeah, that jumped out to me.
Yeah, but interesting card. I don't like. It's hard for me to think that this is going to draw more than the Korkin that they had all four title matches at. Like, that's a thing with it. But yeah. I feel pretty good about this. And at least I would hope that they have another strong angle with Skywalker and Kakuta to build into Dangerous Gate in Tokyo 2 weeks later.
Well, what do you say? 50-50 chance that Homari turns on Shun in the main event?
I think that's possible. I do think if you're doing that, then you're really, really just banking on Shun being able to be like the one person that like get on our back. Then you're the guy that that's going to try to get us out of this, you know,
well,
because
I was thinking about it this way, where I know I advocated 2 weeks ago for partnerships to last in wrestling. I'd like when people have friends, especially babyfaces. It's good when they have friends in wrestling. We don't see that often enough. I do wonder, based on everything we learned from Benkei in 2019, which for those that don't remember, Ben beat Pac for the belt, and then Ben never joined a unit. He had this sort of unholy alliance with Shun Skywalker, and they teamed together through the end of 2019. And I think we would all agree that it did not do great things for Ben specifically. I do feel like perhaps it is more dangerous in the long run if they keep Shun and Homari together, because they're going to have that crutch of not putting them in a unit and just having those guys team together on every single show. Whereas if Homari does turn on Shun.
You need someone to join up with him if you don't have Homari turning.
Yes. And, you know, I a lot of people are leaning D Courage on that. I don't know. I don't see that.
Yeah. I hate that point because that's completely disregarding why Shun turned face turned heel in the first place, and him and Daya and Yoshioka, like there's like, yes, like the idea that the company likes to do where it's like, oh, the deepest betrayals will bring people back together. But they're still, I feel like that jumping right to that point is leaving out a lot of the story leading up to it. You know, like it just seems like no. If you do that, like you might as well break up D-Courage and start a new thing, right? But like I do think long term, Daya and Yoshioka do make a lot of sense, and those turns do often mean down the line some sort of big moment reuniting, but not at this point, like not this soon. And if it's done this soon, then it kind of makes Daya and Yoshioka look like idiots.
Yeah, I don't know if I would say they look like idiots, because again, it was so long ago that Shun turned, but I would really...
It's a mask match, though.
I know. I would really need them to beat me over the head with why they would take Shun back in open arms. Mm-hmm. I could buy it. They have to work with me there. But again, enough time has passed to where I see it being a door that could be open. It is not the door that I would open, though, necessarily.
No, that's true. That it just feels like you still have some time for that. Also kind of worth noting in this like build and like our overall discussion about like Dragon Gate kind of business and where things are kind of going. There's another big Kobe Sambo Hall show between the Korkin and Oda City Gymnasium. This is like their summer festival that they like do they open the doors early and they do kind of a bit of a carnival beforehand.
Yeah. So, I think they did that in Osaka 2 years ago and then Kobe last year, I believe.
Mm-hmm. It's a public holiday too, mm-hmm, for that show.
Well, but, see, yeah, those always do well. You know, I think last year it did very well in Kobe. And then, you know, you've got the Gate of Miyani show in Korkin, which, I mean, it had the benefit of having Okan and Bushi on last year. But I will continue to emphasize the Gate of Miyani show last year sold out Kobe Samba Hall in advance. They added seating and it sold out again. And that is just that wasn't something happening even in 2013 and 2014. So you would hope that that does a monstrous corker number, but I haven't checked any ticket sales on that show yet, so I don't know.
I could pull that up right now because I do have announced some tickets. It's on September 24th. They've already sold out front row for that show.
Okay. That's positive.
That's two Corkins from now, too, because they still have another September Corkin before that.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting.
So at least when I look at that for that one show, because like just for my own peaked interest, yeah, no, they don't even have front row seats available for the Corkin between the one that's happening next week and Gate of Miani. So the first week of the traditional first week of the month Corkin does not have those. And those special front row tickets for Gate of Miani were twice the price of the highest section that they have for the Corkin before that.
There you go. All right, let's shift gears back into to Kobe Samba Hall for a second.
Yeah, absolutely. So do you have anything else on the main event, or should we start talking about the rest of Sambo Hall and the Brave Gate situation?
Let's talk about the Brave Gate.
So we're going to dip back into Buyiden. Ryoya Tanaka on Buyiden had one of two of the title matches on the show, making the first defense of the Open the Brave Gate title against Jun Masaoka, and a really confirming match. It was probably most needed to say he hit the Jokerizer clean this time against Masaoka. But right after that, he nominated his next defense to be against Masaki Mochizuki. Mochizuki took it in good stride and said, yeah, I'm actually under 82 kilos right now. So let's go. Let's do this. And then you had a D Courage versus Mochizuki Dojo trios match happen in Kobe Sambo Hall. It was Mochizuki Sahara and Daiki Yanagiuchi for the Mochizuki Dojo side. And in a flashpin, Ryoya Tanaka already has a win over Mochizuki with the Survive Tilt-A-Whirl Schoolboy. And we're kind of off to the races now with these two title matches at Dangerous Gate. So it's not only already official for the Dream Gate, Shun Skywalker versus Madoka Kakuta, of course. Now, Ryoya Tanaka will be making the second defense of the Open the Brave Gate title, this time against Masaki Mochizuki, of all people.
I wish they would continue the thread with Tanaka and Mochizuki at Cork, and I think that's the thing I'm most disappointed by on that card, is that I want to see them in the ring as much as humanly possible. I find the idea of Mochizuki slimming down to get to a Brave Gate weight to be absolutely fascinating. It's not something that you or I predicted. It's not something we saw coming. It's something that Mochizuki's never done in his, you know, the 20 years that the Brave Gate belt has existed. He's never wrestled for this title. And I think this is a super interesting way of going about it. The thing with Tanaka, and it's funny just what that finish at Kobe World did, the way that it, you know, was able to slightly shift a narrative. Tanaka's wrestling out of his mind right now. I thought he was so good on that Buyiden show.
The match against Jun Masaoka I was close to giving it 4 stars.
And with all due respect to Masaoka, it was the Ryoya Tanaka match. And then for him to show up in Kobe, have the chemistry that he did with not only Mochizuki, but also he's involved in the spot of the weekend with the Akihiro Sahara football tackle on the apron that just knocked Tanaka into next week. He's doing everything at such a high level right now. And I've harped on this and harped on this and harped on this over the last few months of like, we're witnessing in real time a guy start to figure things out in the same way. And it's not a one-to-one comparison. I still think that the guy that I'm going to compare Tanaka to here, you know, historically has had a much higher ceiling. He's one of the greatest wrestlers ever. And I'm not sure Tanaka will ever reach the highs that he did. But I remember watching Will Ospreay in 2017 after he had been in New Japan for a year and being like, oh my God, he's getting it. This is something cool. He in real time has figured out all of these little pieces. He's worked at it for years and years and years. He's finally putting it together in this real way. And Tanaka weirdly reminds me of that, where we always knew he was going to be good. We always knew he was going to be a special wrestler. But in 2025, just little by little, we've witnessed it happening. And now we're witnessing him carry guys in Brave Gate matches. And now I think he can bring out the best of an elder Masaki Mochizuki in this Brave Gate match.
And that's also the idea that I kind of get to. All he's doing in this lead up is pissing Masaki Mochizuki off. Case he got him with like this flashback, and he's being all nice and fun, but I am hoping maybe next time in Sambo Hall or in some of these other shows in the lead up to Dangerous Gate, that we start to see Mochy kind of lose it. Because like, this is such a interesting kind of match with like a guy like Masaaki Mochizuki, who has his own kind of mindset towards pro wrestling, having him in a challenger slot for the Brave Gate, a title that he's never won, let alone challenged for, against someone who is very much on the ascent. It already makes just making this match and the way that they've played off at least the first kind of lead up to it, they've made it really intriguing to me in a way that I didn't necessarily, when they booked the Masayoka thing, I thought, oh, it looks like Tanaka's going to kind of, you know, face off against people. I don't know Masayoka's age, but relatively of the same generation. And maybe that's kind of the way that this Brave Gate run's going to go. And you've already completely turned it on the head with this Mochizuki challenge happening at Ota Ward.
You know, the Masayoka match, because I don't have a ton to say on Buyuden outside of that match and then the main event, which I found to be just incredibly charming. But the Masayoka match, for those that haven't seen it, felt like a 2007 Japanese Juniors indie title match, which, coming from me, is complimentary. But it was a style of match that I don't feel like we're seeing a ton of now. And it almost felt like it belonged on like a K-Dojo comp tape or an
0-1 junior or like, heavyweight like, tournament
like pre-boom DDT, that sort of thing. I enjoyed that vibe. I don't feel like we see a lot of that in wrestling right now.
No. It was a lot of fun. And I mean, I think we've seen Masayoka whenever Rekka and Gaia Hawks have come over for Buyuden shows. But at least for him, I know that they already booked the guy, but it's enough for me to be open to see him again on these shows. Because, yeah, let's talk about that main event of Buyuden. The rest of the show was kind of there. You had before the Brave Gate match, you had this All Japan Junior Six-Man title match, the Hokuto Army versus Paradox. That was a full-on shenanigan fest. And then you had this main event, Madoka Kakuta and Ishin of Z-Brats going against Strong Machine J and Shiro Koshinaka. That was like, that's the way to kind of put it, Case. It was just like really charming, like the way that Shiro Koshinaka kind of was up to do all of the standard accoutrement of like a Z-Brats match and didn't bring it down. It wasn't like exceptional, but it was just fun seeing him kind of go with it. And then afterwards, Strong Machine J call his dad, and his dad like letting it go to voicemail first and then kind of roasting him to close the show. It was like a good time. And on these Buyuden shows that I feel like when we've really liked them, and when they restarted with a good bout of that Lack Corporation money, you got to see some of like these older names, or if not like that, just kind of at least as it works for Dragon Gate, kind of wild ass names coming in for it. And this wasn't as strong as that, but it was like a fun thing to see with Shiro Koshinaka teaming up against his tag team partner's protege.
So I found the undercard of this show to be bone dry. Just nothing for me until the Brave Gate match. It was possibly the least fun I had watching a Buyuden show since its return. And then the Brave Gate match really got me, like we both talked about. I really liked that match. And then this main event, I don't get it twisted, Mike Spears. I have a very low tolerance for old men in wrestling that can barely move. You know, Blue Panther is defying the odds this year. The fact that in 2025, Blue Panther will finish on my SFM 50 list, and maybe at number 50, but he'll be on there no matter what, is pretty incredible, because I do not enjoy watching old guys hobble around. That is not a style of wrestling that I like. Koshinaka is an old guy who was hobbling around, and I felt like this was the best possible version of this match that we possibly could have seen. Now, part of that was, and I think I've made this comp on this show before. If not, I hope it makes sense. But with Ishin, you know, the worst thing that happened in Kurt Angle's career was that Kurt Angle was funny, because he was so good at being funny that it took away from him being Kurt Angle, the wrestling machine. And I think Ishin has a very similar set of characteristics, where Ishin is so good at somehow pulling life and energy and substance out of Koshinaka in 2025, then it is, you know, I want to give him both the highest praise possible, and also I'm concerned that it will one day just detract from an Ishin main event run, because they can do so many things with him. He is, you know, the Swiss Army knife in this promotion. And sometimes I just want Ishin to be serious feared main eventer, but he's so good at all of these other things.
Yeah, I mean, it could very easily slide into Hio kind of being high on your supply, or it could be a thing where he turns it on and you get his October that he had last year with the title match against Yamato and then the match against Mochizuki Jr. I still have belief in him, I would say.
I do too. I mean, look, I think he's a future Dreamgate champion, or at least I think he should be. He has all the talent to be. I was watching him in this match through gritted teeth because he was so good. It's almost like the Mark Briscoe thing. And in my new conversation with Tony Khan, I bring up Mark Briscoe. I talk about how good he is, and I go, well, you know, he does lose a lot. And Tony goes, well, actually, he wins quite a bit, and then proceeds to tell me about Mark Briscoe, which I thought was very funny. But it's almost like the Mark Briscoe thing where he's got to be a booker's dream, because you can do anything with him and you can beat him as much as you want, and it doesn't seem to have an effect. Even at times with somebody like Mark Briscoe, it makes them more popular. With Ishin, he's so good in his role that he doesn't need a serious push. You can treat Ishin differently than Coach Minora, put more focus, time, and energy onto Minora, and Ishin and Minora will at worst be equal of popularity, if not Ishin being more popular than him.
Yeah, and I think that it's just like with Ishin right now, and you have this ability where in this kind of match, and these are the things that if I had the pencil or if I was in the room, you'd see a lot more of. I think that like Ishin's power of charisma is only going to play off further down the road at like such a high level when they finally go and decide, all right, we're going to use this second generation team. Like we're going to go all in for that, because you're going to need to have someone of that kind of contrast in there with Strong Machine J, who I feel like getting into this match and like continuing kind of his little like having like kind of like the denouement or like resolution of him and Kakuta kind of. You have like another act of this, but like you're going to need to have Ishin's charisma when you have him and Mochizuki Jr. like interacting more and more, I feel like. And that's kind of what I came out of this, because he's like able to play off of Koshinaka in such a way that I'm like, oh, I feel like now we always will have the guy who's going to be able to be to just show his ass whenever we need to have like a big outsider to come in, and he's going to be totally fine. I kind of like the comparing him with Hio, like the thing that I think Ishin has always had is the ability to kind of turn it back on. Whereas Hio, like that kind of is who he is as a wrestler now, and you have to kind of accept it. And I don't feel like I have that tendency with Ishin so far.
I don't either. It's always something to monitor, but I look, I'm still as bullish on him as anybody is. I will say on the front of Hio, I think Kobe World was a really good show that was well booked. I did not like the order of elimination and the Triangle Gate match. But the thing that I've come away from after watching this Kobe show and seeing Ben and Hio in the ring together once again is we have to get the Twin Gate belts on these guys. I can't believe they are not currently the Twin Gate champions.
Yeah, I guess like for me, seeing them together, it's always been kind of great. In this match with that they had in Kobe, we got to have a lot of Takashi and Buyuden, and maybe this is me watching these shows consecutively, Case, but I felt like we got way too much Takashi in that match, and it kind of for like a show that it, later like the Team Mexico match in the Royal Sambo, I feel like really kind of brought it around. It was not necessarily the thing that I wanted to see on the Sambo Hall show, but yeah, no, Ben and Hio's chemistry, they're now, as long as nothing weird happens, the clubhouse favorite, I feel like, for Rey de Parejas 2026.
You'd think so. I mean, I'd like to see them run the table. I think this team is good enough to where, if we're going to use Rey de Parejas as the timeline here, that's a team that should be headlining Rey de Parejas Cork and Hall show. You know, Ben and Hyo against, if you know you're going to have it be Kakuta and Ishin or Shuden Hamare, you know, project ahead 7 months, whatever you want it to be. But their chemistry as a tag team is absolutely electric. And that does feel like, you know, Hyo's 9-year career, right? We've talked about Hyo for 9 years of wondering where he slots in on this roster, where you and I, for a very long time, were the two Hyo fans on the planet. And then he turned heel, and then he got much more popular. And we've seen them try all of these different things with him. And I think the tag team with Ben, like that is the best version we're going to get out of him, because he's not a Dreamgate champion. We've seen him have the Bravegate belt with, I think, mixed results. And, you know, SB Kento being gone certainly does not help things, because they wanted to tell a story there. But he and Ben as a tag team just jump off the page to me. We saw it in Vegas. We saw it at World. Even in this Kobe show, you're right, way too much Takashi. Way, way, way too much Takashi. But Ben and Hyo together, I'm telling you, it is the team. I leave in world going, I can't believe these guys are the champions right now. I felt like they had a perfect time to pivot away from Jason and Minoru, who did their job as Twin Gate champions and did it well. But I was kind of ready to see the next step of that story. And I think that step was just Ben and Hyo being dominant in winning. And I'm so afraid that Love and Peace is just going to be this unit made up of great wrestlers who have great matches that lose all the time. And I want them to ride this unit. I want Kame to have a bigger push, and I want Junior to be even more involved, and I want Ben and Hyo to be the goddamn Twin Gate champions.
And I feel like the two are just like perfect complements for each other, and they're kind of the good case of when you don't have a clear leader in a unit. I know sometimes Hyo is, and sometimes Ben is portrayed as that leader, but the two of them kind of complementary are kind of like a Doyoshi thing, right, at this point. And if anything, that's kind of something that's been missing since 2021. Like, we have not had that. And yeah, maybe some of that goes into the departures that I was alluding to in my Doomer kind of discussion that we had, but it's just nice to see that, and that's the kind of thing that gives me a little bit more confidence for Love and Peace, and especially like the idea of, okay, you have these two and then the three young guys, and at least with where they are in their careers, like we're at points where I guess we're doing the Rhea Fuda thing again. And Mochizuki Jr.
Let's talk about it. We can end the episode on Rhea Fuda. Let's
end it on Rhea Fuda. Rhea Fuda beat Mochizuki Jr. with the Tatsumaki roll in a fun special singles match, kind of second match on the show that kind of felt like I need to ask you a question, Case. As the last known holder of Rhea Fuda stock, are you thinking you're going to the moon right here, knowing that Sendai is coming up in like 6 weeks?
Mike, here's my thoughts on Rhea Fuda beating Mochizuki Jr. I don't fucking care. I need Fuda to do something interesting against somebody that doesn't have the last name Mochizuki. Do that.
That's a very good point.
Let me see that, because we're at a point where he had the incredible debut match against Masaki Mochizuki in November of 2021. We are sitting here in July of 2025, and you're right, this match was a lot of fun, but it was against a guy named Mochizuki Jr. I need him to do something interesting, compelling, and thought-provoking that isn't against this family. I know Fuda can have good matches against the Mochizukis. I've seen it many times. I need him to do it against somebody else.
Yeah, the worst thing that could happen for you trying to project out Rhea Fuda's career is that secretly Mochizuki has another son that's about to debut, right?
Well, that would be the greatest thing to happen to me. It would be the worst thing for Rhea Fuda.
Before we get out of here, a point that I saw Jay making over the week on Blue Sky, given everything, you had Fuda do that match, Daiki and Sahara, other than pulling duty with Mochizuki in that D-Courage match, did a match against from Ganbare Poro, Mizuki Watase and Munetatsu Nakamura at Buyuden. Jay seems to be of the belief that we might be closing up shop in the dojo soon. Do you think with like these guys now at this point in the career, with Kimura coming on. We have the road for the I'm blanking the other guy's name that's about to debut. Also, do you think we're at the end of the road for Mochizuki Dojo this time?
I mean, I'd hope so, not because I don't enjoy the unit, but just because I want these guys to get integrated in the roster more. You know, I think Sahara has a long way to go to be a finished product, but I think Sahara is good enough to, let's just hypothetically put him in Paradox. I think he's good enough there. And I it's funny, like, I feel like people are really out on Daiki, and I'm like, I'd put him in Love and Peace tomorrow. I'd put him in Vibes tomorrow. I'd turn him heel and put him in Zebrats. You know, I
want to see him do a heel turn real bad. I feel like he should be the new Lost Post and whatever the next heel unit should be. That should be his next role.
Absolutely. You know, my disappointment with Daiki is that he ditched the Cork and Hall employee gimmick, and I was expecting a full rebrand, new gear, new haircut, maybe a new name. And instead, he just lost his ring jacket. And I still don't understand the point of that, because now he's just a dork with less of an emotional connection to the audience, whereas at least when he was the Cork and Hall employee in that building in particular, that audience could latch onto that. But I watch him wrestle. I think he has the makings of a really, really good wrestler. You know, he sort of reminds me of MC Casey. You know, his career, yeah. His career feels like it could be one that would mirror Casey had Tozawa never left. You know, I don't see Daiki getting any Dreamgate shots, you know, even failed Dreamgate shots, but I watched the guy wrestle, and like, that's a Bravegate caliber wrestler. You know, I would love, even during this title ranks, I think Tanaka's gonna have the belt for a while. I would love to see Tanaka versus Daiki. I just want him to do something else. The scary thing is, and Fuda has this same issue, and I think with Sahara they'll end up avoiding it just because of the way that Sahara's been positioned and the way that he looks, which I think really matters in this conversation. But the problem is that Daiki's been losing for so long that now when he starts to win, it's almost going to be distracting. You know, we're going to be focused on Daiki winning because he's lost, you know, every match for 2 years. And I wish they would have handled that differently. I think with him, I still think he has all the talent in the world. I really like his upside still, and I know a lot of people do not, but I worry about his booking. I think he's been malpracticed a little bit this year, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, and especially given how much of stuff he's had with, like, the Young Dragons Cup going into the disbands match against Zebrats, and then the Bravegate title. At least when you look at the three of them, the company still has a level of consistent interest in Daiki. It just feels like you had a level of momentum coming out of April, then you say you're doing away with the gimmick, and instead you just kind of look at his rainbow tights now and you go like, yeah. The gimmick kind of let, at least for me, a little bit, accept his innate dweebiness a little bit. Like, that's going to be a thing that I think the heel turn needs to happen to kind of get it in a way, because, like, an issue for him, and, like, they kind of play into it with the losing streak and the way that he's kind of portrayed himself, is he kind of comes off like a little bit of a lovable loser, and that I could see how, like, when you stretch that out for so long, like, it stops being like anticipation, and especially after you have him like face Yamato, it becomes a level of distraction there. I do kind of wonder when we talk about these guys, and like similarly with like people like Mochizuki Jr., that we're sometimes in this promotion so used to see them be so off to the races with guys, where maybe with some of these wrestlers, like you see like Kato, they were always going to go pretty fast, pretty quickly with him. And then now he's kind of slotted where he is. Whereas, you know, like the Mochizuki Jr. entered the promotion when he was 19. And maybe Daiki being a little bit older, and then Fuda being on the roster longer, but being injured a whole lot, and Sahara being going through college with that, it makes us feel like we should see more of them and maybe see them get accelerated a little bit more. But like, I also I wonder a little bit now how much of this is that we see these guys from the start, and then we see them four or five times a month. And before we know it, 5 or 6 months in, we've seen Daiki Yanagiuchi 30 times if he's been healthy and like that. And there's a level of expectation where we should maybe be looking more towards the long-term play with them.
This is always my point is there's no promotion better at debuting wrestlers. It's the second step in their career, that second chapter, that's always the hurdle that Dragon Gate has. And if you can clear that hurdle, then I think you're on your road to stardom. But we see time after time, guys that we really like the raw materials of, we really like their foundation, but sometimes in that post young boy pre-push phase is where guys really seem to struggle.
Yeah, because I feel like that's kind of where, because I do lump Mochizuki Jr. in with these three, where they're kind of at, where like Mochizuki Jr., I feel like has had like the second step, and then like some, and in some ways a little bit like the tension gets dropped and it's like, oh, you're Mochizuki's son and this is kind of what you're doing a little bit, when in reality it's like, no, he's 20 years old or 22 years old and take the long-term play. Not everyone is going to be Shun Skywalker and accomplish everything by age 29, you know?
Absolutely.
Well, should I run down the rest of the results for these two shows before we get out of here, just so that we have them down?
Sure.
All right. Just because I know we talked about them and around them, the Buyuden show, you had Masaki Mochizuki and Punch Tominaga versus Daga and Owada-san representing Team 2000X, and Noah. Daga wins with the sharpshooter on Tominaga. The Mochizuki Dojo versus Gambare Pro match that I mentioned. Watase got the win over Yanagiuchi with a elbow strike. Rita and Mochizuki Jr. versus regular person Minoru Sawa and Fuminori Abe was with Rita with a retanic on Sawa. The Takashi Fest was won by Takashi with a powerbomb on Susumu. We've talked about Roya Tanaka's first defense with a Stardust pressed over Jun Masaoka in the main event. Strong Machine J and Shiro Koshinaka defeating Z-Brass, Madoka Kakuta, and Ishin. Strong Machine J with the machine suplex on Ishin, going back to Kobe real quick. Love and Peace, Hyo, Benkei, Jackie, and Rita versus unaffiliated Don Fuji, Kanda, Sachioko Boy, and Takashi. Hyo gets the win with the senton on Sachi. Fuda pens Junior with the Tatsumaki. Paradox versus Hoho Lun, Hori, Reach, Tominaga, Monde Ryu, and Yosuke Santa Maria. It was Kagatora with the Gura Makakari on Tominaga. As we mentioned before, Ryoya penned Masaki Mochizuki with the Survive roll-up and the D-Courage versus Mochi's Junior, Mochizuki Dojo match. Team Mexico defeated Natural Vibes Flamita with a Firebird Splash on UT. And then the Royal Sambo, all Z-Brats and X-Z-Brats affair went to a draw when Shun Skywalker gave a blaster on the apron to Madoka Kakuta. Case, is there anything else you want to touch on this week before we're out?
I don't think so. We'll be back next week, a little bit later in the week, not to do an on-air production meeting, but maybe a Thursday record
for that Korgamal review.
Great. I am seeing Death Cab for Cutie when we normally record, so I will not be here. They are doing the 20 years of plans, and they're doing it at a very small theater, so I will be doing that.
Jeez. I was about to say, 19-year-old Mike Spears, Plans was a big album for him, so... Yeah,
I find Soul Meets Body to just be an impossible song. I just, the vocal range that he hits, the lyrics of it, the music behind it.
Yeah, you have to be all right with Gibbard's vocals and be a Death Cab fan. Like, he's not a good voice. Ben Gibbard does not have a good voice.
I hate singers. I always describe them as talent show singers, people that have this classically trained background. That is nothing for me. I prefer a Ben Gibbard or an Isaac Brock or people like that. And so I've seen Death Cab twice before, definitely at least once. And it's always really enjoyable. So yeah, I'm looking forward to that. Did we talk last week, maybe it was before we started recording, about the OC and how I started the OC?
Where are you on the OC? We've been debating doing that, but right now Kings has never seen Downton Abbey, so we're watching rich people have their lives inconvenienced right
gotcha.
Now.
I remember that show being a thing. Never watched it. I am so the first season is 27 episodes, and I think I'm
oh,
like
yeah.
I'm like 18 deep on it, and I got it. I mean, it is, as somebody that likes that sort of show, you know, as we've discussed, Big One Tree Hill guy, really like Gilmore Girls when I ran through it last year. The first season of The OC is unbelievable. I mean, it is really impressive what they do with that show.
It was high school water cooler television, if there ever was.
Yes.
Like, I like distinctly, like junior year of high school, this show came out, and really up until like, how spoiled are you on the show?
I know almost nothing.
Okay. There'll be a certain event that happens in like the, in a future season, then the show definitely changes.
Okay.
But like, okay. Especially like that first season where like, I feel like that there is a TV tendency in some of these shows of everything happening all at the same time. Mm-hmm. And that very much was like the case to it. Like has Seth run away yet?
Seth has not run away. No.
Okay. Okay.
No, yeah, Seth is he the last stuff that I saw was Seth choosing the short-haired blonde girl over Summer.
And then
I looked up the blonde girl and I found out that she's like a far-right Hollywood.
Oh, Samaria Armstrong has gone through some things.
I was like, oh, she is so charming at this show. It was such a bummer to look on her Instagram and see posts from 2020 about how masks are tyranny and things like that. Like, oh, God, that sucks.
Samaria Armstrong was definitely a person where I thought like there were going to be stars coming out of the OC and she was going to be one of them. Like, yeah. She had a stint on Entourage, too.
I know. I know.
And then, like, the last thing I remember her doing was, like, appearing in, like, one episode of Sons of Anarchy. And, like, that's it. And then she went off the deep end.
I think she was in the second edition of God's Not Dead, which came out last year. Yeah,
man,
I know that was right up her alley. It's a shame. Very, very charming actress on the OC. I wish she would have lived a different life.
Dude, the episodes you're watching right now, they're the amount of viewers that they had. And in 2004, this gives you the scope of how, as we kind of always talk about a little bit, Kay, is that consumption is so scattered now. Mm-hmm. 12.27 million for one episode, and the next one, 12.7 as well.
So I got an advanced copy of this book. It comes out next month, but the book, to come full circle to Death Cab and Postal Services, is called Such Great Heights, and it's all about the indie rock explosion in the 2000s and the 2010s. And the reason that I started watching The OC, and it had been on my list for a while, but the author, and I'm about three quarters of the way through this book, I can't recommend it enough. If you like Death Cab and Phoebe Bridgers and The National, and things like, this book is fantastic. It's really, really well written. But there's a large chapter dedicated to the impact of The OC and what that did for certain bands, especially Death Cab. But I didn't realize that I think the first 8 episodes aired during the summer, and mm-hmm. then they took a slight break and then did the rest of season 1. So, yeah, I'm blown away by it.
Yeah, and there was real anticipation for it coming back. I remember that distinctly in high school. Like,
yeah, it's great. I'm glad I gave it a whirl, cuz I'm really enjoying it so far.
And it launched the career of now one of our greatest crypto skeptics, Ben McKenzie.
Ben McKenzie, crypto skeptic, Adam Brody, who, if you did not watch his Netflix show with Kristen Bell last year, I would highly recommend it. I'm somebody who at various points in my life I've held a lot of Kristen Bell stock, big fan of her, but I was ready to sell. I was ready to be done with her and just completely remove. I thought she had completely lost it and just got to a point where she was too rich and too famous to do anything compelling. And then their Netflix show, which I believe was called Nobody Wants This, came out.
Yeah.
And I said, Kristen Bell once again has found her fastball. This might be the most interesting thing she's done since Forgetting Sarah Marshall. And I greatly applaud her for that.
Not a Good Place fan.
Okay. My issue with The Good Place is that, as in this will sound insane to you, because it sounded insane to the person that I used to live with who was a big fan of The Good Place. I can't handle the concept of that show. If you've ever heard Joe Lanza talk about death and how much he fears death, I echo a lot of those same sentiments. And the idea of a show being based in the afterlife, as silly as it might sound, especially a comedic show like that, is too much for me to handle. And I just can't watch it. And I am a card-carrying member of the Kristen Bell fan club, a card-carrying member of the Darcy Carden fan club. Who doesn't like Ted Danson? I can't do that show.
You know, I am so to like one side of it that I am so confirmed that in my beliefs of an afterlife that I just pretty much go like, oh, this is complete fantasy and I'm able to do that. But I completely understand the idea.
Can't do it. I've tried. Yeah. I'm my brother loves the show. I'm sure I would love the show. Can't do it. Just absolutely. I've watched episodes and it just messes with my mind in a way that I do not want to explore it further.
No, I totally get that. Well, buddy, I think that's going to do it for us this week on Open the Voice Gate, as Case said, and we decided on our production meeting. We'll be back with y'all next Thursday into Friday after Tuesday's Cork and my move in Case's Death Cab concert.
I'll full review of Death Cab. I'll be sure to tell everybody all about it.
Yeah. Let me know if you find Chris Walla and you're able to talk about him and Brian Alvarez's backyard days.
Oh, God. All right. I will do that.
You can follow us on social media at Open Voice Gate. Case is on Twitter at _inyourcase. I'm on Twitter at Fujihei. If you'd like to join the conversation, step inside the Voices of Wrestling Discord. That's where we have the great Dragon Gate channel where people are discussing the shows live. We have a member who does a great match of the week poll, doing an interesting one this week. Case, I don't know if you saw this in the Discord. Andrew is setting folks up with BB Hulk defending the Open the Dreamgate title against Naruki Doi, Cyber Kong, Mondai Ryu, and KZ.
I will have to hop in and talk about that match because that I remember watching that in real time and the discussion points coming out of it.
Oh,
and
sure.
Just, yeah, that was. I was officially hooked on Dragon Gate starting in May of 2014 after that King of Gate show with Tozawa versus T-Hawk. And so all of those 2014 Korakuens I have extremely vivid memories of. And I am now, as I talk out loud, I remember that my iPad that I used in high school, the background on that for a long time was the group photo of Doi holding the Dreamgate belt with all of Mad Blanky around him and the fallout of that match. I have very, Hell very yeah. vivid memories of that show.
Definitely the coolest guy at your school.
Oh, people point. Loved it. Yeah, it was a great conversation starter. And what followed was a normal conversation and not interrogation to what was wrong with me.
No. Yeah. No, everyone was completely even keeled.
They loved
about
it.
That.
They're all about it. Yeah. You know how understanding high schoolers are.
Absolutely. But we'll be back with you next week to talk all about the Korakuen and everything else. Have a good week, everyone. Take care.
Hello, everyone. My name is Taylor.
And I'm Kelly.
And we are the co-hosts of Jumping Bomb Audio, the number one show all about the world of Joshi Pro Wrestling. Every other Monday, we're coming at you with news, show reviews, and previews of upcoming Joshi action.
So whether you're just getting into the scene or you've seen it all, this is the show for you.
Check us out on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network and wherever you get your audio.
Hello, Voices of Wrestling listener. Dave Ryan here. Have you ever wondered to yourself, how many hidden gems are hidden away inside the last years of World Championship Wrestling? Have you ever asked yourself how many tenuous gags can be made about the name Mike Enos? And have you ever thought about what it sounds like for two Irishmen to interpret a very chaotic company through its B-show? The answers to all this and more are just a click away. Check out Days of Thunder every second Thursday on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network.